The subject of this week's programme would have hated it. Throughout her life, she shunned publicity. She never gave interviews, and there are no recordings of her. She died in 1926 at the age of 57. If she'd lived to an old age, she might have been on Woman's Hour, but it's unlikely. Please, please don't supply information about me or photographs of me to newspaper correspondents, she wrote to her family. I always throw all letters asking for an interview or a photograph straight into the wastepaper basket, and I beg you to do the same on my behalf. She is Gertrude Bell, arguably the founder of modern Iraq. And my guest, who's chosen her, is an Iraqi-born scientist, Jim Al-Khalili, who's now Professor of Physics at the University of Surrey and also a regular TV science presenter who's just published a book on Arabic science. Jim, growing up in an Iraqi family, what did the name Gertrude Bell mean to you?
I remember my mother, who's English, having a book about Gertrude Bell and had heard about her in history classes at school, the fact that she was so instrumental in the founding of the state of Iraq.
To which we're going to come. Do you find now, with your contemporaries, both in Britain and back in Iraq, that the name is still well known?
It is, yes.
Our expert witness in a studio in New York is Gertrude Bell's biographer, Janet Wallach. Her book, Desert Queen, The Extraordinary Life of Gertrude Bell, was published in 1996 and has been translated into 12 languages. Janet, if most people have even heard of Gertrude Bell, the idea they have of her is probably that of yet another intrepid Victorian lady traveller drawn to the Orient. She's more than that, isn't she?
Oh, she's far more than that. You know, she was the chief intelligence agent in Baghdad and Basra during World War I. She was truly an extraordinary woman.
Let's leave her early life and let's work backwards a bit. She comes into her element in 1918, at the end of the First World War. At that time, there's no such place as Iraq, and there's never been a state there. So how does she come upon the scene, Janet?
She was part of the military in the Middle East. She was the only female political officer in the British Army during World War I, and was sent to Basra to help map the way from Basra to Baghdad for the British Army.
Jim, am I right in thinking that there'd never been a state in Iraq before? It wasn't an established country.
It's always been part of something else, whether it's ruled by the Persians or the Turks or part of an Islamic empire, the Byzantine Empire, and, of course, for many centuries, the Ottoman Empire, which ended in the First World War. So it never had. It was known as Mesopotamia. The Arabs in the region refer to it as Iraq, but it never had autonomy and borders as a state.
The Ottomans had a policy of not settling. So, unlike the British, they would pay locals to run the administration. But for the most part, the Ottomans really stayed away.
So, in a sense, the British found themselves in control of a sort of vacuum, at least from the point of view of a centralised state. They'd driven out the Turks, and Gertrude Bell is on the staff of the British Army, sitting in Baghdad, probably knowing more than any person alive about internal Arab politics. This is an extraordinary circumstance, isn't it, Jim, for a Victorian lady to find herself in?
But then she was very remarkable and unlike any other Victorian woman I know of. I mean, she was not only so well-versed in the culture and the language and the lifestyle of the Arabs and the indigenous population of the Middle East, but she was just a woman of remarkable intelligence, who was driven, who was just so self-confident, a can-do person. So, yes, against the backdrop of Victorian England, she's incredibly remarkable, but even today she would stand out as a remarkable person.
What had driven her to the East, Janet?
She was sent to Persia as a young woman to stay with her uncle, who was the British envoy to Persia at the time. The real reason, I think, was to find her a husband. And she did find somebody in the British embassy that she fell in love with, but whom her parents rejected and who then died very early on. And I think she went to the East after that, really in search of his soul. It was a very romantic sort of idea at the beginning. But she learned 7 languages, spoke Arabic fluently, and became a serious archaeologist, traveled throughout the area and had the confidence in herself to meet every important notable, every important sheikh, all of the leaders, rulers in the region, including the holy men. And that's how she established herself.
Give me a sense of the woman that she was. If we were to have met her, what sort of a woman do you think we would have encountered?
Some people might have regarded her as arrogant. I mean, she'd look down her nose at sort of inferior beings. But, I mean, the truth is she was intellectually superior to almost everyone around her.
Yes, I was very glad that she wasn't around when I was writing this book. Because I think she would have been so intimidating that I would have been absolutely terrified of her. And she had great contempt for almost all women. There were very few women that she respected, very few women that she felt close to. But she was extremely charming and knew how to turn on that charm, particularly with people in power.
It's interesting, Janet, you mentioned that she was contemptuous of other women. She was against the suffragette movement, wasn't she? You know, that she didn't feel that women were qualified to have a say in the running of state and should not be given the vote.
I think part of it was that she felt that women hadn't been educated enough to earn the vote. She wasn't alone in that.
How would she have been seen by people in Iraq whom she met? The position of women was a fairly inferior one, or certainly a very separate one. She must have seemed quite extraordinary.
Very much so. And I think there's actually a very nice quote in Janet's book where a sheikh is trying to convince his people, his clan, to agree with something she'd asked of them, to fight alongside the British against the Ottomans. And he says, you know, she is so remarkable. We all know that Allah has created women inferior to men. So this woman is so remarkable. Therefore, how great and courageous and remarkable must English men be if this is an example of their women?
Their women.
You know, that was one of my favourite
lines.
It's
wonderful.
She must have been in some danger, though, Janet. I mean, there are huge physical risks for anybody, particularly a woman in these places.
There were points along the way, particularly in her travels as an archaeologist, when she was in danger, and she had been warned by the British and by the Turks not to travel because the tribes were at war and because anybody in that region, particularly European and, of course, a woman, would have been vulnerable. But, you know, she had tremendous poise and stature, and I think that when she had meetings with important men, that her gender disappeared.
I often wonder how things would have turned out differently after the 2003 overthrow of Saddam if the Bush-Cheney machine had a Gertrude Bell on hand to advise them on how to nation build, rather than the absolute shambles and disaster that followed.
Well,
I'm with you, Jim. I'm with you 100%. And in fact, the United States had almost no Arabic-speaking people when
it's
we went
incredible,
in there.
Isn't it?
But she might have met the same wall that she met in some of the diplomats whom she dealt with. I mean, here's a diplomat, Mark Sykes, talking about her. A silly, chattering windbag of conceited, gushing, flat-chested, man-woman, globe-trotting, rump-waggling, blethering ass. So not everybody
didn't
fall under
her. You think she didn't like her?
No. But here's another quote from an observer at the time. She was, I think, the most brilliant creature who ever came among us, the most alive at every point with her tireless energy, her splendid vitality, her unlimited capacity for work, for talk, for play. She was always an odd mixture of maturity and childishness, grown up in her judgment of men and affairs, childlike in her certainties, and most engaging in her entire belief in her father and the vivid intellectual world in which she'd been brought up, which takes me back full circle, Janet, to the beginning. Tell me something about that world that had formed her and about her upbringing.
I think of Gertrude Bell as a true daughter of the empire. She came from a family that had coal mines and iron works and employed something like 20,000 people in northern England. they provided the iron and for the ships that for the British ships that set sail around the world. And so she was very much a part of the empire, not just England. She knew the importance of trade and the importance of politics around the world. Her family had many friends in the foreign ministry and in the British government. Her mother died when she was very young. She was three. And she was very close to her father, who was of tremendous intellectual curiosity. He loved to travel. He really didn't want to be a businessman. He didn't want any part of his father's business. He loved to travel, and he was a curious man who encouraged her to be the same way. But what was so odd was that for all of the independence that he inspired in her, she was also very dependent on him, as the quote you mentioned before. She was like a little girl with her father. And even when she fell in love, she obeyed her father when he said, "Come home from Persia. I don't think this is the right man for you. And just wait and see if things change." So for all of her strength and formidable intelligence and intellect, she was when it came to her father, and then later on with men like Percy Cox, who was her superior in Iraq, very much the charming little girl.
Do you think, Jim, that one of the reasons why she didn't seem to find a fiancé when she came out as a debutante on the London scene and then went for the wrong man and her father forbade it, do you think she was actually just looking for someone like her father, or is that psychobabble?
I think she was certainly looking for someone who could at least go some way to being her intellectual equal. And I don't think she found the man who could fit that pattern.
Well, I think she did. She found him in Richard Doughty Wiley.
Who was married, of course.
Who was married. So, you know, maybe that was part of the deal. That maybe that was part of why she fell in love with him, because she wouldn't have to marry him. She knew he was Catholic. He was married to a rich woman. He wasn't leaving his wife. But he had the intellect, and he had the strength and the adventuresome spirit. He was a true diplomat. Military man.
Here she is writing a love letter to him. Not many of her love letters, I think, survive because, well, he was married, and I suppose he destroyed the letters. But this certainly doesn't fit with the idea of a flat-chested, rather desiccated man-woman. She writes, "Dearest, when you tell me you love me and want me still, my heart sings and then weeps with longing to be with you. I filled all the hollow places of the world with my desire for you. It floods out to creep up the high mountains where you live."
It was really tragic because she was madly in love with him. But the real tragedy, I think, for her was that they never, as far as I could tell, and believe me, I read every letter and in between the lines of every letter, but I don't think that they ever consummated their love. And that was really sad. And then, of course, he met a tragic end. Or maybe I shouldn't tell this.
No, tell us.
And people well, he was one of the officers who led the troops, the Australian troops, at Gallipoli. And he was one of the first to be killed at Gallipoli. So he died a truly heroic death, but so sad and so early on. And she, again, there was that sort of searching for his soul in whatever she did in the Middle East after that.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where Professor Jim Al-Khalili has chosen the life of Gertrude Bell, the often widely forgotten English woman who almost created modern Iraq. Because by the end of the First World War, Jim, she encounters a curious position that Britain is in. The Ottoman Empire falls apart. Britain then has to decide what to do with it. They can't just walk out.
Absolutely. And of course, to try and come up with a deal with the French, who also have interests in the region. And it's something that every Arab school kid learns, you know, in the whole of the Middle East in history, that the map of the Middle East, the borders, the lines that separate Iraq from Syria, from Jordan and Saudi Arabia, are lines drawn up by the British and the French in divvying up these countries and see which country will be under whose administration.
And what does she find in what is now Iraq? What greets her? Is it very much the situation that we see now, Sunnis, Shias, the Kurds in the north?
Absolutely. I mean, it's quite remarkable, the parallels. I mean, people like Rory Stewart, who's written about the British and American forces in Iraq after 2003, try to bring together the various sheikhs who oversee the different tribes and the different loyalties between the Sunnis and the Shia. It's exactly the same thing that has to happen after the First World War. After the Ottomans are defeated and they're trying to put together a nation, albeit under the British administration, choosing the appropriate people to make sure that all interests of all of these different disparate groups are satisfied.
And what's the solution that Gertrude Bell proposes, Janet?
She came up with the idea, really, of a constitutional monarchy. She certainly felt that it should include the Shiites in the south, the Sunnis in the middle, and the Kurds in the north. And one of the reasons that she was so insistent upon including the Kurds was that without them, there would have been a Shiite majority. And she believed firmly that the Sunnis should have certainly administrative authority, that they had been the ones who had been in the government under the Ottomans, that they knew how to run a country. And she wanted to make sure that they had a strong enough voice. But if you just took Basra and Baghdad as the two primary areas, the Shiites were in the majority. If you included the north with the Kurds, who were ethnically distinct from the Arabs, but who were Sunni in their religion, then Iraq would have looked the way that Gertrude Bell wanted it to be.
But then, Jim, this balance with the Sunnis holding the balance is effectively Saddam Hussein. Is Gertrude Bell really the author of Saddam Hussein?
In a long line, after the monarchy, after all, King Faisal comes from Saudi Arabia, so he's a Sunni as well, and he's succeeded by two other monarchs. And then when the Republican Revolution takes place in 1958, it's still a Sunni-dominated government. The Ba'ath Party that comes in 1968 is a Sunni party with its basis in Baghdad, north of Baghdad, and in Syria. So, yes, until now, essentially, where we have, in as much as one can, have free elections in Iraq, this is the first time that the Shia Arab majority have had the bigger say.
It's only now, really, that Iraq is departing from the Gertrude Bell plan.
I would say so, yeah.
Jim, right at the beginning, before she'd met and talked to Arab nationalists, she felt quite doubtful about the possibilities in Iraq. Too many warring tribes, too fragmented. Do you feel, as an Iraqi or half-Iraqi, that her first conclusion was the right one and that the country is, in fact, ungovernable except by despotism?
Yeah, it is. Sometimes, you do wonder. I'm actually, unlike a lot of people in Britain, I supported the overthrow of Saddam. I grew up in Iraq, in an Iraq that was under the Ba'athist regime, but not under Saddam's rule. So it was a dictatorship, but it was a benign dictatorship where one learnt to keep their head down and not criticise the government. And things were relatively safe there. Mm. But my father knew that once Saddam came to power, and of course he was the vice president, the power behind the presidency, that when he assumed the role of president, things would go downhill very quickly. So we left actually within a few weeks of Saddam coming to power. And had we not left, had we left it a few months, that door would have been closed. We would have been caught up in the Iraq-Iran war in 1980. And certainly I and my younger brother, I'm sure, would have been conscripted. My father's a Shiite Muslim. My mother's Christian, British. You know, we were expendable people as far as Saddam was concerned. And also, my father's ancestry goes back to Iran. So they were seen as, you know, Persians rather than true Arabs. But I do understand and have sympathy for this view that Iraq was only united, that there weren't allowed to be these sectarian divisions and tensions because of Saddam and the Ba'ath Party's iron rule. But I'm not quite sure I wholly subscribe to that. I think the Iraqi people are more pragmatic than most other Arab nations. And I think people understand what is needed to get on together.
The British are always attacked for drawing these random borders. But Gertrude Bell talks in her letters home about how she worked long hours with the townsmen, with the tribal leaders, on trying to figure out what exactly made sense in terms of the borders between Mesopotamia and Turkey or with the states in the south, and how difficult it was. And indeed, nobody even understood the concept of borders. These were nomadic people, and they went where the grass was good for their herds. And so the idea that they would have to stop at a line because somebody had put it on a piece of paper made absolutely no sense to the tribes. So it was a difficult proposition to draw these borders, and it took long hours and great work to do it.
Because here she is describing the life of a diplomat in the city as it then was. I find these social duties rather trying, she said. These idle women here have nothing to do all day long and expect me to call and be called on in the 1 hour of the day when I can get out and think of nothing. The result is I never get out at all, but I'm going to stop this. It makes life too intolerable and it makes me ill. So they can think what they like about me, but I won't bother about them anymore.
It would be interesting to find out how she was thought of among the British wives,
yes,
of the diplomats.
I think we
in
can
Iraq.
Guess.
You know, absolutely.
Oh. Despised would be the word.
Now comes the other rather sad bit of her life. She became lonely in Baghdad, and she became personally and politically isolated when King Faisal no longer really needed her. But England was no longer her home. She couldn't go back there, could she?
At the very end, she was weak. She had been ill many times. She had suffered malaria over and over again, a number of other diseases. And the doctors had actually warned her that if she went back to England on a holiday, that she would not be able to make the trip, the return trip to Baghdad. And so she was faced with either going back to England to live out the rest of her life or to stay in Iraq. And there was no question in her mind but that her soul was now in Baghdad.
And she then throws herself into archaeology and created the Baghdad Museum, the one that was looted or partially looted after the U.S. invasion. She was the first director of antiquities.
Yes, she was, and she spent her time over coins and little bits and pieces of shards of pottery. But she cared deeply about all of that because she cared so deeply about the culture of the people and the great history of the Iraqi people. And that was one of the things that she so proudly taught Faisal.
Do you think, Jim, that her death at a very young age was suicide?
It certainly seems to be. I mean, I think this would have been something that many of her friends and close acquaintances would have tried to cover up, because it's not a pleasant ending for such a remarkable story. But as far as I am aware, from what I have read, from what Janet has written and others, it would seem that, yes, she did decide, you know, the loneliness overcame her and she did decide to take her own life with an overdose.
It was a very sad ending to a very great life, but she did die knowing that she had become the person with a capital P that she had always wanted to be. And I'd like to add a note to that, that I have heard now that the bronze bust of her that was buried in the basement of the Antiquities Museum is now back in the museum, and I believe it's upstairs in the lobby. And her name is now back in the textbooks in Iraq, and I think that's a wonderful ending for her.
My thanks to Jim Al-Khalili, who chose the great life of Gertrude Bell, and to our expert, her biographer, Janet Wallach. Goodbye.